St. Crispin's Day.
This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, "Tomorrow is St. Crispian." Then will he strip his sleeves and show his scars and say, "These wounds had I on Crispin's day." Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Parry the King, Bedford, Exeter, Warwick, Talbot, Salisbury, and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we, in it, shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he that sheds his blood here today with me shall be my brother. Be ne'er so vile. This day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day.
King Henry V, Act 4, Scene 3. Zack Hatfield had been sitting in the visiting room of the Clatsop County Jail. Not the open room with the tables and chairs for family visits, but the walled-in security chamber with a plexiglass-separated cubicle equipped with telephones for communication, while a corrections officer loomed watchfully behind the prisoner he was there to see. Stephen King's crime was one of the most serious on both the Oregon and the federal statute books, and under state regulations, he had to be kept under strict restraint and supervision. Facing Hatfield behind the plexiglass, King looked ghastly. The former manager of a major grocery in Seaside was not wearing the orange jumpsuit of American shame, but ragged garments with old-fashioned black and white stripes that, for some reason, had never fallen out of use in Clatsop. The communications phone he held limply in one quivering hand. His once cherubically handsome face was now fish-belly white and gaunt, with the remnants of a double chin and once chubby cheeks drooping loosely from his skull in wattled folds of skin. His brown hair hung in lank rat tails from his head and showed new streaks of white that hadn't been there a few weeks before. His horn-rimmed eyeglasses were taped together with a huge lump of scotch tape at the hinge on the right side of his face. Hatfield decided against asking King how the breakage had come about, nor did his friend volunteer the information. Hatfield could guess in a general way what had happened, but saw no need to hear this particular variation on the hideous American theme of middle-class white man suddenly hurtled into the nightmare world of prison. Besides, King was so wrapped up in his own personal misery that beatings by whatever Mexican or meth head had hurt him didn't even seem to figure in his mind. He appeared disconnected from his body, feeling only the endless suffering in his heart and in his soul. All he could do was to keep coming back to the same refrain, over and over again, like an animal in a trap, trying desperately to chew off its own leg in order to escape.
"How can she do this to me?"
he moaned.
"I loved her! I love her still in spite of all! I gave her everything I could, I had everything I had! Lydia and the girls are my whole world! I would have moved heaven and earth to make her happy! I don't understand what I do wrong!"
"You aren't the one who's done wrong, Steve," Zack told him. "But do you mean to tell me, honestly, that you never saw any of this coming?" I did. So did Charlie and Lynn and just about everybody else. Okay, maybe nothing this foul, but we all knew Liddy was going to break bad on you at some point in time. The storm warnings were all there. She was always so brittle. Always the chip on her shoulder, always that odd little look in her eyes, creeping people out. Every time I was over at your house or we ever met anywhere, Liddy managed to find some way to twist the conversation around and force some kind of politically correct feminist or pro-fag crap in there like she was some kind of suburban Jane Fonda. The constant little needling remarks, always trying to get in people's faces, always trying to pick a fight with you even when there were other people present. The pseudo-intellectual airs, quoting from Sartre and Sylvia Plath and ancient Greeks as if she knew what the hell she was talking about, which I happened to be well-read enough on my own to know she didn't. Her inability to be happy, the so-called community activism that always seemed to involve helping somebody other than this community. You're telling me you never recognized the signs?
Oh, she was always like that, ever since she came back from university,
said King with a shrug.
I mean, what else do you expect from the U of O? I just figured she rebelled against her religious upbringing when she went to college, trying to be chic and fit in, and then she just sort of never grew out of it. I actually think it was sort of cute, kind of her way of retaining her youth.
Yeah, well, baby tarantulas grow up into big fucking poisonous spiders, Hatfield reminded him. But King was back onto his old refrain.
Why, Zach? I don't understand it. Why?
He went on in a monotone. Because it's expected of her, said Hatfield.
What?
Tony tells me that Marie Campisi asked Liddy that very same question. Why? Hatfield went on. She said because she was past 30 years old and it was time for her first divorce.
She's planning on more?
Asked King in a disconnected daze. Yeah, apparently it's the big thing in all the feminist self-help and psychobabble books now. They call it life scheduling or some such shit, explained Hatfield. The first marriage is for kids, which of course she always takes with her in the divorce settlement, after soaking hubby number one for every penny she can. Apparently the lesbian thing is also something every truly liberated woman is supposed to schedule now. At least one major lesbo relationship in your life or else you're not a true woman. I think Pocahontas may be in for a shock, though. I actually looked that crap up on the internet, and after her lesbo fling, if she decides she prefers guys, Liddy is supposed to try to bag an older man who's very wealthy and who will most likely kick off by the time she's 45 and leave her set for life. Or a wealthy older dyke if she decides she wants to keep on munching carpet. I think all Miss Proudfoot has to her name is a welfare check and a line of noble Native American woman crap.
Woman?
Repeated King. Hatfield nodded. That's the way the Fims write it. I think that's how it's pronounced. It's one of those PC shibboleths the media and the intelligentsia are trying to introduce into the language and make into an accepted and then mandatory term. Like the word George Orwell wrote about in 1984. Newspeak. Mind control. Just like we have to say African-American instead of nigger. When a totalitarian society controls the language, controls the words that people use in speech, and punishes them for using any words or terminology other than the prescribed ones, eventually the whole population will be so afraid they'll start using the politically correct terms in their very thoughts to make sure they don't blurt out some word that'll make them lose their jobs or get them arrested for hate speech. The state ends up controlling not just their behavior and their speech, but shaping and controlling their very thoughts. Any questioning of the politically correct orthodoxy becomes literally unthinkable, because we don't know how. We don't have the words for it. The United States has been aiming for that for years. Anyway, your life has to be destroyed because it fits into Liddy's life schedule, apparently. It's all about her, of course. You're a used component, and now she's throwing you away.
But if she wanted a divorce, she didn't have to do this.
King waved his hand around to the surrounding walls and plexiglass.
Why this?
To make absolutely sure that she gets Caitlin and Judy, Hatfield replied patiently. He had explained the situation to King several times before, and so had his court-appointed attorney, but it was obvious that King simply could not yet wrap his mind around what was being done to him. Under both the federal hate crime laws and the Oregon Diversity and Tolerance Act, any conviction for hate crime or hate speech automatically terminates a convicted offender's parental rights. If both parents are convicted, then it takes a village, moves in, and grabs the kids and sells them. But in this case, since Liddy can show that she was in what she will claim to be a stable lesbian relationship, Once you're convicted, she'll walk into family court and walk out 10 minutes later with Caitlin and Judy wrapped up in a bow. A present from the judge.
All for a single word?
Screamed King in horror. The walls were closing in on him, and he was clearly beginning to go insane.
Just because I said dyke?
Hey, buddy, settle down, snapped the guard behind him. You're in enough trouble already. I'm a pretty laid-back kind of guy, but it's my job to make sure you don't talk any more hateful stuff. And if someone hears you, it'll be my ass in the ringer, and they'll slap another count on you. He took the phone briefly from King's hand and said to Hatfield, Sir, you've got 5 minutes left. Hatfield ignored him, and when King got the phone back to his ear, he went on. Martha Proudfoot claims that you made her feel threatened because of her gender, her sexual orientation, and her race. I think she claims you said dyke squaw, actually. You're lucky the DA kept it in state court, and so you're only looking at 5 years for the speech. If they'd gone federal with it, they might claim that making the Proudfoot woman feel apprehensive was an act of hatefully motivated assault, which they can do under the statute, and then they could hit you with actual hate crime, which is mandatory life. Maybe without parole if the judge thinks you actually intended to strike her.
Strike her?
Laughed King bitterly.
My God, have you seen that creature? She's built like a bulldozer. I just lost my temper is all when I walked into my living room and found them doing, dear Christ, what they were doing. I can't even talk about it.
The chocolate ritual, said Hatfield. I know. It's supposed to be for bonding between female lovers. Most people have no idea what homosexuals actually do. You were unlucky enough to get a crash course.
The girls were upstairs,
whispered King in horror.
They were upstairs, Zach! How could Liddy do that with Katie and Judy upstairs? Not to mention the fact they must have known I will be home any minute.
Oh, they knew, said Zach with an assured nod. My guess is that they wanted to provoke exactly the kind of incident that occurred, so they could hang this hate speech rap on you. And thereby Liddy gloms onto your daughters and the house and all your property. No messing around with alimony or child support payments or constant trips back and forth to court. You'll be a certified hater, one bang of a judge's gavel, and she gets the whole kit and caboodle. I wonder what the Proudfoot woman's cut'll be from that night's work. Steve, you know that the FBI had some child psychologist and a couple of agents in the other day, and they grilled the girls for 4 or 5 hours?
Yeah, Pritkin, my lawyer told them about that. Caitlin's 6 years old, Judy's 4. What in God's name could they expect to get from children?
Demanded King incredulously. Whatever Liddy coached them to say. But I did hear something interesting. I named no names, of course. He figured King could guess that he was referring to Lynn Ekstrom's daughter Christina, who was a police dispatcher in the Justice Center, but he didn't think it was a good idea to mention her anywhere her co-workers might hear her name in connection with a hate speech case. They asked the girls if you ever said any bad things about black people or Hispanic people, as well as gay people, that kind of crap. This thing up in Idaho last month has them really freaked out and maximum paranoid. The Marines just recaptured Coeur d'Alene a few days ago, and the feds are seeing white supremacist rebels under every bed now. They asked your girls if they'd ever seen any flags in your house, green, white, and blue ones.
That's lunacy,
gasped King in shock. In case you hadn't noticed it, the people who rule us are lunatics, among other things. Behind King, the guard was holding up 2 fingers. That's the 2-minute warning.
My life is over now because I uttered a single word in anger,
muttered King, still unable to comprehend the magnitude of his fall. Your life is over now because you uttered a single word in anger, confirmed Hatfield.
No one on earth will help me,
King moaned. Hatfield glanced up at the guard behind the broken man in the orange jumpsuit, uncertain as to how much the guard could hear of his end of the conversation. No one on earth will help you, Hatfield repeated aloud. But before the guard led Steve King away, Zach caught his friend's eye and he winked. Outside the jail, the rain was falling softly, steadily, and the light was already fading. Zach pulled out a wireless phone, punched in a number, and quickly texted a message. Are you alive? Before he hit send, he thought rapidly and decided that the question might get picked up and noticed by some kind of government monitoring, and so he changed the message simply to 5 question marks. Then he hit send and waited in the rain under a streetlight for several long minutes. Finally, the little window on the phone lit up and he saw a reply. I am the ghost of Christmas past. Zach Hatfield took a deep breath and, after a brief moment of indecision, the last he would ever experience in his life, he texted back, I want in. Call me. Then he closed his cell phone and walked off in the rain toward his battered 10-year-old Toyota.